I try, though I do not know that I always succeed. In fact, I know that sometimes I do not succeed. But I try always to keep myself not in the foreground so that I blur the gospel, but always in my mind when I preach the gospel. Because I recognize the fact that what I say applies first and foremost to myself. And that my task in life is both to save myself and them that hear me. And that first task is the bigger one when all is said and done. You've had a great privilege hearing Brother Pickup this week. I know of no man in my acquaintance that I hold in higher admiration, a man that I believe who truly loves the Lord and seeks to live that which he preaches. We have the noblest of tasks tonight as we talk about Jesus as the Son of God. We want to turn our attention to that. In the 16th chapter of Matthew, there is a question Jesus asked his disciples. Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? He immediately got a variety of answers. Some say you're John the Baptist, some Elijah, some Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Then he turned to his own disciples and said, but who say ye that I am? And it was Simon Peter. At his best on this occasion, though at his worst on others, who said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. When we think about Jesus and who he is, we are confronted with claims that are extraordinary and with facts that almost defy the imagination. We have just a few moments tonight to touch the hem of the garment, but we are going to try to come to a better appreciation of Jesus and who he is and what his deity signifies to each of us. In order to set the stage for the lesson, I would like to pose before you alternative explanations of Jesus. In fact, in John, the 7th chapter, in the 27th verse, when Jesus presented himself to his contemporaries, they mused about him and they said, we know this man's parents. We know who he is. He comes from Nazareth. But how is it that he does what he does and says what he says? They had a difficulty in understanding that and explaining that. And they were not unique, because all through the ages, these have been the two alternatives. Either Jesus actually lived, and Jesus as an historical figure was of such a nature and character that he made a profound impression upon his disciples, so that the accounts that we find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and in the writings of Peter and Paul and James and the rest, were deep impressions that he made upon them, lasting impressions. And therefore, he produced his own picture through their writings. Or, on the other hand, Jesus never lived. His historicity is not to be accepted. And that's the popular view. It is the most popular view among religious people today. Sad to say, and strange enough, it is almost the most popular view among those that claim to be his followers today. Those that claim to wear the name Christian. Oh, some man by the name of Jesus of Nazareth lived and made extraordinary claims about himself. He was a good man, but certainly he was not what is portrayed in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These are myths. These writers have embellished the materials. They have, in fact, invented the picture that they have presented to us by Jesus. As a result, they have become the world's greatest writers of such extraordinary genius that they defy the imagination. I believe that it was an author by the name of Haygood who wrote a little book entitled The Man of Galilee, who said that no dramatist, no matter what he may attempt, can draw a man or characters taller than himself. And I certainly think that that's true. If you go back in the history of literature, you will find out that it has always been thus. No matter how good and how noble a character may be, he is the invention of the author. So much so that you really come out with the disposition, this person is too good to be true. Or the person is portrayed in such a sordid way, or is portrayed as a tragic figure who ought to have everything going for him, but somehow blows it. And terrible things happen. Always, it is the author who is heralded, and not the character. Because the character is the invention of the author. It isn't that people in church buildings, for the most part, erect their shrines to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And yet I know that they're canonized as saints in some quarters. It is Jesus of Nazareth who receives the attention. It is the product of the author that is significant. He is the one who is looked upon. He is the one who is extolled. He is the one who is held forth to us. But if Jesus was nothing more than the mere figment of the imagination of these authors, then there has to be some explanation historically. Either he was the product of the Jewish expectations of the Messiah, and therefore his contemporaries drew from those sources and painted a picture that would come out right. Or he was the product, perhaps even the highest finished product of all of the history of mythology as represented by the Greeks and the Romans. You know, in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul said, God, in his wisdom, chose to defy, really, and expose the wisdom of man and demonstrate it as foolishness by the wisdom of the cross, which he calls the foolishness of the thing which is preached, the message about Jesus. He says, because Jews seek for signs and Greeks seek after wisdom. And without carrying this to extremes and taking too much out of it, I think that this is a generality that will hold. There have always been those two clusters of people of a religious disposition. There are those who have always sought to be tantalized by the extraordinary. Those individuals who in the extreme are carried away with emotion. And the old religion of Baal, where the prophets of Baal worked themselves into a religious frenzy and ecstasy around the altar of Baal, and eventually cut themselves with knives as the blood gushed out, and cried day and night, "O Baal, hear us," is still manifest in about half of the religious responses that you see in the world today. And then there was always that reserved, intellectual, sedate type of religion that was represented by the intellectualism of the Greeks in Jesus' day and time. The Jews seek for signs and the Greeks seek for wisdom. The fact of the matter is, Jesus did not fulfill, in any sense of the word, the expectations of the Jews concerning the Christ. Take, for instance, the political and the religious parties of the Jews of that day and age. The Zealots expected a political leader who would deliver Israel, emancipate the nation from the shackles, the control, the oppression of the Roman government. A great king like David who would pull his sword and lead the armies of Israel in battle. The Pharisees looked for a religious leader who would lean to the far right, who was extremely conservative, and who demanded exactness and preciseness in the keeping of the legal and traditional elements of their religion, even sometimes to the disparagement of the principles of the law. And the Sadducees were looking for a religious leader who leaned as far in the other direction to the left, an individual who denied the existence of angels and didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And the Essenes were the separatists. They looked for a religious leader that would take them out into the desert, that would separate them from the world, that would establish a community of believers that was pure and that was totally untouched by the world. When Jesus Christ came, nobody wanted him. If he ate with publicans and sinners, they called him a drunkard and a gluttonous man. If he separated himself, then they considered him to be too good for the people. Nobody was seemingly pleased with what they saw. He didn't fulfill their expectations. And it was no better with the pagans. They were myth makers. And to argue that Jesus Christ is the culmination of the whole history of pagan mythology is almost laughable. You do not find the myths of Greece and Rome rooted in the chronology and the geography of the Gospels. Well, look with me, for instance, at a couple of passages in the New Testament. Go back with me to the first chapter of the book of Luke. Well, let's not take that one. Let's go to the second chapter, the beginning of it. When the birth of Jesus is going to be described, it would have been so easy to have described it in nothing more than the terms of the birth of Zeus. But it says, "Now it came to pass in those days there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment made when Quirinius was governor of Syria." You notice that here there is special, specific reference made to these individuals who were the political rulers of that day and that age. And when in the third chapter we have the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist and of Jesus Christ, the third chapter begins, "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, and the high priest of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came unto John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness." Everything is set within its historical, chronological, geographical setting. That's the way it was prophesied. When in Micah the 5th chapter it was prophesied that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem of Judea, it blows our mind to realize that Bethlehem was the least of the cities of Judea. And furthermore, that in Palestine in the 1st century A.D., there were at least two Bethlehems. What were the odds of predicting that 700 years before the events took place? I'm glad that I have lived in the space age and that I have lived in the state that had the privilege of seeing the first rockets shot to the moon. But do you realize that Jules Verne predicted that that would take place in the state of Florida? Do you realize that Jules Verne predicted that it would take place in Central Florida? I'll tell you what, Jules Verne was no Micah, because he said it would take place from the west coast of Florida instead of the east coast of Florida. Bethlehem of Judea, where Jesus was born. Myths belong to the beginnings of civilization. They do not come to full blossom at the height of the advance of civilization, as did the story about Jesus. It was C.S. Lewis, who we so often know as a writer of religious fiction and even some religious serious literature, was first and foremost a scholar of medieval English literature. And the myths of Arthur were at the heart of a lifetime of his study. He said, "I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths all my life. I know what they're like. I know that no one of them is like this account of the life of Jesus." And he said, "You show me a man who says they are, and I'll show you a man who doesn't know anything about literature." Now, Jesus is not the product of Jewish expectations. When he came, he was the exact opposite of what they expected the Messiah to be. He is not the culmination of the whole history and expectation of mythology. He is the exact opposite of the wisdom that the Jews sought and of the signs, or that the Greeks sought and the signs that the Jews sought. Well, who is he? This Jesus of Nazareth. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John did not invent Jesus. The fact is, they could not have invented Jesus. In Acts, the 10th chapter, verses 36 through 38, when Peter preached to the household of Cornelius, he said this about Jesus. And, it's so straightforward, it's so simple. "You yourselves know concerning the things that are said about Jesus of Nazareth." In verse 37, he says, "that were published throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism that John preached, how God anointed him with the Holy Spirit and with power, who went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed of the devil, for God was with him." This was common knowledge. As Paul said to one of the Roman rulers, he said, "This thing was not done in a corner. This thing was not hidden. The events concerning Jesus, his death, his burial, his resurrection in Palestine." And in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, Peter explicitly says, "We have not followed cunningly devised myths when we made known unto you the power and the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." They spoke the things that they had seen and heard. They testified to these on our behalf. But I want to direct your attention to a statement that the Lord made to his disciples over in the 14th chapter of John's Gospel. It's a remarkable passage to me, because Jesus really gave a twofold basis upon which individuals could accept him. He said in the 11th verse, in answer to Philip's question, "Show us the Father," And his response had been, Philip, have I been so long time with you, and yet sayest thou showest the Father? He who hath seen me hath seen the Father. How sayest thou showest the Father? And then he said, Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the very works, the very miracles' sake. Now I want you to notice something about that passage which is highly significant. There's a disjunctive there, an either-or situation. He says, Believe me, or else believe me on the basis of the miracles that I perform. And you know there are these two ways that we come to believe in Jesus. And either of them is justly sufficient. Both of them are doubly sufficient. And yet both of them become the basis for faith in the New Testament. Jesus says, Believe me. Well, he was a believable being. His character was sterling. Take, for instance, when Pilate examined Jesus, he said, I find no fault in this man. I find no basis for a charge against him in John chapter 18 and verse 38. And when the centurion came around to pierce his side, or one of the other centurions standing at the cross, he said, Surely he was Son of God. That's the kind of influence he had on pagan rulers and pagan soldiers that were involved in his condemnation and his execution. Take his disciples. Paul cried out in wretchedness in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 15, I am the very worst of sinners. I am the chief of sinners. And yet when he described Jesus in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 21, he said he had no sin. And Peter, in Luke, the 5th chapter, the 8th verse, said, Depart from me, O Lord, I am a sinful man. And yet Peter wrote that beautiful passage that we have studied in one of our lessons in the evening in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. And John said in 1 John chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, If we deny that we have sinned, we make ourselves liars. And yet he said concerning Jesus in 1 John 3 and verse 5, In him is no sin. And even Jesus, as he stood in the presence of the Jews and angered them by saying to them, You are of your father the devil, and the works of your father you do. He was a liar from the beginning, and you're his children. He immediately challenged them concerning himself. He said, Now, which one of you can convict me of sin? Either he was a hypocrite or an imposter to make claims such as that. He claimed to be equal with God, not on just one occasion, and we're not going to really take the time. There have been some very fine things that have been said about Jesus as the Son of God in the Gospel of John. This morning we were treated to a very fine lesson on that. But just look at some of the statements as they build. John started with the proposition, In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And from that time forward, he begins to develop in a paradoxical sort of way the fact that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory, the glories of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. In the 5th chapter, he said, My Father and I are one. The Jews took up stones to stone him. Well, Jesus wasn't just claiming that he and the Father had the same purpose, that they were on the same track, that he was preaching that which God had revealed in his Word. Every prophet of God had done that, and they weren't stoned for that. They were going to stone him for blasphemy. Why? Because being a man, he made himself equal with God. And they couldn't fit those two things together. And rather than accept it, they rejected him. I'll tell you what. If we keep arguing and arguing about whether Jesus is human or whether Jesus is divine, I want to tell you something. We're going to wind up denying the truth of the Bible. That's just the way it is. He said in John the 8th chapter, before Abraham was born, I am. The Jews got it immediately. I am. You are saying of yourselves that you are the eternal one, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, as Jehovah God claims himself to be. That's blasphemy. In John the 10th chapter again, he said, I and the Father are one. And the Jews again take up stones to stone him, not because he has worked a miracle, but because he has claimed equality with God. And even in the 19th chapter of John, in the 7th verse, the statement is made about him by his contemporaries. He made himself the Son of God. Well, not only is that true, but he claimed for himself the very works of God. He claimed to forgive sins. Read the account in Mark, the 2nd chapter, of the paralytic man, where Jesus said to this man, whom they had brought to Jesus to be healed, Son, thy sins are forgiven thee. And they began to say among themselves, who is this man who says thy sins are forgiven thee? Only God can forgive sins. And he says, you reason correctly in your hearts. But in order that you may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins, the only thing I want you to understand about that is that I am claiming prerogative with God. He said, I'm going to say to the sick of the palsy, arise, take up your bed and walk. And when you see him do that at my word, then I want you to believe my word that I am in the Father and the Father in me. I am the Son of God in a unique sort of way. God is my Father. And he received worship, not only from men, but from angels. The Jehovah's Witnesses have tried to say, well, that's nothing more than honor. If you turned over to Hebrews, the 1st chapter, and the 6th verse, it is quoted there from Deuteronomy, the 32nd chapter. Let all the angels of God worship him. Go back and read that psalm. It is a psalm of praise to Jehovah God. And Jesus arrogantly ascribed to himself that kind of worship and that kind of praise. And his followers, when individuals tried to fall down and worship them, said, get up, I myself am also a man. And when John fell at the feet of angels to worship them, they said, get up, worship God. He alone is to be worshipped. Jesus forgave sins. Jesus received worship as God. It wasn't just his character. You know, people are believable. I sometimes tell a story that still amazes me, but I was down in Florida one time, and I was getting the front end of the car aligned, and the bolts were rusty, and I had to wait for them to put some WD-40 on them or something like that. And so it was about noontime, and it was hot, and I needed something to eat, and they didn't even have a Coke machine. And I said, is there some place to eat? And they said, well, yes, down the road 2 miles, there's Peter Pan. And I said, well, I've got to try and make it. I got about halfway, and I was really feeling that Florida heat and humidity bearing down on me. Finally, I saw this bar over at the side, and I thought, well, I'm going to inquire there and at least see how far I've gone. Or maybe somebody will throw me a sandwich out. I stuck my head in the bar and I said, can any of you tell me where I can get a sandwich? At that time, an old fellow said to me, he said, You can go down to Peter Pan. I said, yeah, I know I can go down to Peter Pan. I've been going for an hour. He said, well, you're about halfway there. I said, well, thanks. And I turned to walk off. And about that time, I heard this gruff voice. The fellow said, wait a minute. I turned around, and this great big, burly, beer-bellied man standing at the door. And I thought, he's going to draw a switchblade on me. I have upset, you know, their little party in there. And about that time, he reached in his pocket, and I started to duck, and he pitched something toward me, and he said, here. He said, here's the keys to my new pickup over there. He said, drive it down there and get you something to eat and come back. He said, I'll still be here. Brand new pickup. I thought, man, I want to get on the interstate and keep going. But I thought, no, you know, this guy probably is going to let me get away, and then he's going to send the police after me, and he's, you know, going to collect some insurance or something. And I thought, well, wait a minute. This guy knows I'm such a good guy. You know, he's decided to do this, and so I'm going to do it. And I went down, I got my sandwich, and I came back, and I went to the door, and I pitched him the keys, and I said, thank you. He said, you're welcome. Now, why did he do that? He didn't know me from Adam. I don't know. But, we do trust people. Sometimes people we don't even know. And Jesus was believable. But it was more than that. He certainly justified his claims and his teachings. When he finished the Sermon on the Mount, they said he teaches as one with authority and not as the scribes and the Pharisees. He didn't do what everybody else did, including Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This was done that it might be fulfilled by the Scriptures. Or, thus saith the Lord through the prophet Isaiah. Basically, his approach was, I say unto you, you have heard that it was said, but I say unto you. He didn't say perhaps, maybe, possibly. He always spoke with authority. Was he a legend? Was he a megalomaniac? Was he a liar? Was he a lunatic? I don't see how you could come to that conclusion from the story that is found. Compare him with Jim Jones or David Koresh or Father Divine, or anybody else that's making the same kinds of claims today, they pale into insignificance. Give them a few years, and they're nothing but a footnote in a history book. But there has been more written about the life of Jesus Christ, even about his enemies, than all the other heroes and great men of history put together. He said, or else believe me for my very work's sake. Have you ever just really thought in terms of the power of the culmination of the accounts of the miracles? John says in the 20th chapter, at the end of that chapter, many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name. He only selected 7. Jesus turned the water to wine. He healed the nobleman's son, the lame man. He fed the 5,000. He walked on the water. He healed the blind man. He raised Lazarus from the dead. And in all of these, he showed his power over his ability to take that which is nothing but water and make the best of wine out of it. His power over space. If you knew somebody who is desperately in need of a physician, critically ill, and you knew that it was several miles away to the station where the ambulance had to come from, or the paramedics, or you knew that it was 10 miles away to the hospital. As those minutes ticked away, they would be critical. Had you been here, Lord, my brother would not have died. But in the case of the nobleman, some space meant nothing to him. Distance meant nothing. He could heal from a distance as easily as up close. Time meant nothing to him. A lame man who had been lame from birth could be healed. Or a lame man that had been that for 30-something years could be healed. quantity. He could take just a few loaves and fishes and multiply them to feed the multitude. 5,000 men. And have baskets full of fragments left over. 12 baskets full, perhaps symbolic, concerning the fact that he could feed the tribes of Israel abundantly and overflowing. Natural law, he could walk on water. Misfortune, a bruised reed will he not break, and a smoking flax will he not quench. As his disciples mused about this blind man, who sinned? Did he sin? Did his parents sin? He said, this man is an opportunity for us to work the works of God. Let's forget this business of who sinned, this man or his parent. And I'm going to tell you, sometimes I have a hard time bringing myself to say that with regard to those who have AIDS, who brought it upon themselves. Maybe this man did. The point that Jesus is making is that we're here to help people, take them where they are, and bring them to a better place. And when it came to the matter of death, he said, Lazarus, come forth. And a body that had been stinking in the grave came forth alive. And he did it all in lieu of the fact of his own prophecy concerning himself, destroy this body, and in 3 days I will raise him up. Well, when John comes to the end of his gospel, considering his claims, considering who he was, considering his teaching, considering his miracles, over in the 20th chapter, there is the climactic account with which we'll quit. The disciples are present together, with the exception, obviously, of Judas, who hanged himself, and the exception of Thomas. Jesus appeared to them. Later, Thomas came in after Jesus had left, and they said, we have seen the risen Christ. Thomas says, oh, that can't be. Dead men don't rise. No, we've seen the risen Christ. He said, unless I am able with my own eyes to see him and with my own hands to touch the body that was crucified, unless I can see the holes in his hands and the holes where the spikes went through his feet and the hole in his side where the spear struck him, I will not believe. Later, Jesus appears and Thomas is present. Our disposition is to call him Doubting Thomas. Jesus walked up to him and he said, Thomas, he said, I want you to reach forth and take your finger and I want you to put it into my side and I want you to take your hand and I want you to hold my nail-pierced hands. Be not faithless, but believing. You think Thomas simply shouted out, dead men do rise. Now he went far beyond that. He cried out, my Lord and my God. The very thing that John began as a proposition, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, is the conclusion that Thomas shouts aloud, my Lord and my God. And he is yours and he is mine. We can be like the multitudes of the Jews and the Greeks. We can look for something spectacular. We can look for something better felt than told. We can look for some sign directly from heaven. But all we'll get is the sign of Jonah. As Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. We can try to figure it all out and give all of the answers that we can. And we can try in our wisdom to create some better than life image as a substitution for Jesus of Nazareth. and cast him aside as a good man and nothing more, but he stands before us to confront us who he is. Who do you say the Son of Man is? Are you willing with Peter to come forth tonight and say, he's the Christ, the Son of the living God? I believe that with all of my heart. I will die with him to sin. I will be buried with him in baptism and rise with him to walk in newness of life. And no matter where he leads me, I'll put my hand in his nail-pierced hand. And where he leads me, I will follow. And if you want to do that tonight, then do so. All together we stand. All together we stand.